I find this topic extremely difficult intellectually, and I also probably the most difficult of any that I encounter in the whole healthcare ethics area. I also find it just difficult personally, much more difficult than most of the other topics in healthcare ethics. And I know there have been a lot of other heavy topics this week, so sorry if we add one more element to what might detract from the celebration atmosphere that is part of coming up here. But nevertheless, these are extremely important problems. There is, as you know, I'm sure from the newspapers, a whole range of cases here. There are chromosomal defects running from fairly mild ones to extremely severe. The most severe don't really pose a problem because the child is either stillborn or miscarriages or dies very soon. The less severe, one of which is Down syndrome, as Larry notes, fortunately not now so commonly called mongolism, but still called that. That is, as he noted, a racial slur of sorts. Down syndrome is less severe and poses a very serious decision in cases where it is linked with another medical defect. The question then becomes whether to treat for the other medical defect to save the life of the child. One of the very famous cases that has been discussed a lot in the literature is the so-called Johns Hopkins case. How many of you have heard of the Johns Hopkins Down syndrome case? No, you haven't batted that around at length. Good,
maybe
okay.
Maybe not.
We'll focus on that today. There's a short film out on it, if you ever get a chance to see it. I think it's simply called Who Shall Live? In the Johns Hopkins case, the Down syndrome infant had an intestinal blockage, which could very easily be removed by what is now fairly routine surgery. Parents, I think the child was about 2 weeks old, refused consent for the surgery. The hospital did not take the case to court. If they had taken the case to the court, they undoubtedly, as I'll explain later, could have gotten a court order overriding the parents' refusal of consent and warranting the surgery. The hospital has to get somebody's consent to do the surgery. It can't do it by itself. It either has to get the parents' consent or a court's consent. The hospital did not go to court to try to overturn the parents' refusal. The child, because of the intestinal blockage, starved to death over 2 weeks. A very anguishing, in this case, the question of whether to let the defective newborn die is even more anguishing because of the particular process of dying. An easier case, probably for most people, is one of the most extreme, and that is an anencephalic infant. That is, an infant without a brain, or at least without a cortex, and only parts of the brain stem. Anencephaly is the term. It is not as uncommon as is sometimes thought. I don't know exactly what the statistics are. The proportions on a number of these defects run much higher than we think. Down syndrome is something like 1 in 700 or 800 in the population. But that's a lot. 1 in 600, 700. I mean, that's a tremendously high risk if you're thinking of yourself having a child, for example. And I think the total is under one, is a little higher than 1 in 500. Something like 1 in 450 are going to have some serious genetic defect. Now, if you perform amniocentesis, the test during pregnancy, which is done at about the 16th week, maybe it's down to 14 now. John, can you help me out on that?
14, right?
14. If you do amniocentesis, which enables you to detect all chromosomal defects and some other defects too, but not all genetic defects. And if the fetus is defective, you abort, then of course you're around the particular problem of letting a defective infant die. You've thrown the discussion back into the abortion discussion. The abortion in that case is performed 3 or 4 weeks after the amniocentesis because it takes that long for the cultures or whatever it is, the test to be completed. Another fairly common one that you read about in the ethical discussions of this is spina bifida. It poses another different and peculiar dilemma. It can, in certain cases. Spina bifida is a protrusion of the, it's usually linked with meningomyelocele. I'm not sure which term denotes which problem, but part of the spine protrudes from, the spinal cord protrudes from a hole in the spine. And because of that, severe mental retardation can result. It depends on how high this protrusion is. And you get many other health complications. Many spina bifida persons, if they do grow to adulthood, have great difficulty walking, are handicapped in various ways, and above all are incontinent and have a number of other problems. And this mental retardation can range from extremely severe to relatively mild. Now, the diagnosis is often made about how severe the effects of that will be by the location of this protrusion on the spine, so that a neonatologist may be able to make a fairly good guess as to at least the range of abnormality in later life. If an operation is not performed to correct that protrusion of the spinal cord, the child is likely to live much less long than it would if you did perform the operation. The problem is, if you don't perform the operation, it's not sure that the child is going to die. It may be a 90% guess that the child is going to die within 1 year if you don't perform the operation. If you do perform the operation, it's likely to live 10 or 12 years. That may be the statistical guess that an informed neonatologist, experienced neonatologist, would come to in that kind of case. Well, suppose you think that the problems of retardation and other health problems are so serious that you don't want that child. And let's suppose you could also argue, we'll get to this problem later of how to do this, argue that for the child's own sake, it would be better if that child did not live to be 10 or 12 years old. So your guess is, for those reasons, that you should not perform the surgery. However, if you don't perform the surgery, you have no assurance that the child's going to die within the first year. The child may live to be 8 or 9, and may live with much greater problems because you didn't perform the surgery than that child would have if you had performed the surgery. And that really makes the dilemma hard. And that brings up then the very tempting alternative of killing the spina bifida infant in that case. If in fact it would be permissible to withhold treatment, hoping that the child, as it very likely would, die within a year, rather than it likely living 10 or 12 years, would it not be much more humane? If you're going to do that, would it not be better to kill the child now and not have any of the risk of it living more than a year with more severe problems? I mean, it would seem to be for the sake of the child that you would kill. If you're going to let it probably die by not performing the surgery, wouldn't it be much better to kill it? Yeah. Then, now, at that point, people really divide very sharply on some of their intuitions. Some people say, well, if it's better to kill it than to let it probably die, then since it is completely prohibited in my morality to kill it, I am also completely prohibited from letting it probably die, and I must perform the surgery. I can't let it probably die because there's a better alternative, killing it. But killing is prohibited. Therefore, I must perform the surgery. Others come to the conclusion that this is one case, one of the very rare cases indeed, where active infant euthanasia or active killing of a child would be permissible. That's a huge, huge issue, as you can see. Well, there are many, many other particular defects. I've mentioned three: anencephaly, spina bifida, and Down syndrome. I want to get to the Down syndrome case in some detail a little bit later. But let me just review the law on this. The law strikes me as harboring almost the same considerations that initially Christian morality poses for our consideration here. A striking coincidence here. The law is incredibly conservative on these problems of letting, on this whole locus of problems of letting in defective newborns die. Almost every single case that has gotten to court has led the court to say, treat. Never let die. Treat. The cases where the court hasn't done that is where medically the case has been so ambiguous that you could argue that it just isn't necessarily medically best to treat. There's so many ambiguities in the situation, and the expenses are extremely high, and complications engendered in the next couple of years if you perform this surgery are incredible. And in some of those cases, the courts have said, parents have the right to refuse treatment. But in almost every other case, almost all the clear cases where with medical treatment, you could keep the child alive for a fairly significant length of time, and under much better circumstances than it is now, much better health than it is now, the courts have said, you must treat. Now, what the courts have not done is to say, hospitals and doctors, you must bring the case to court. The law has been very clear on most of these cases when the case has gotten to court. But the law has not said, physicians or hospitals, you could be prosecuted if you didn't take the case to court. The law has not said that. So there's an odd combination of rigidity and freedom in the precedents that have come out of the general line of court decisions. I can't portray them as unanimous in all cases because we have a variety of levels of courts, and not every case goes to the Supreme Court, so it's not all resolved by the same court. But the general line of thinking in the court cases is treat. No parents, no hospitals, no doctor has a right to say, this child does not have a right to life. It has a right to life. That, I think we could note, follows very clearly right out of the last trimester part of the Roe v. Wade abortion decision. The last trimester in abortion cases, Roe v. Wade said in 73, the Supreme Court decision, requires that the life or health of the mother be at stake before you can remove life support, i.e. the womb, from the mother. And even then, if it's the last trimester, you cannot kill the fetus. You can remove it, and since it's possibly viable in the last trimester, maybe you can keep it alive after the abortion. That was what the Edlin case was about in Boston about 5 years ago. Edlin was accused of killing a fetus that was possibly viable. Was also accused of not keeping it alive, but there were sort of two charges. He was also accused of strangling it. But if we're going to say that in the last 3 months of pregnancy, you are obligated to keep the fetus alive once it's aborted. That is, you're not going to say merely that you can't kill it. Then, logically, certainly we must also say you must keep an infant alive. It's not just that you can't kill it, you must also keep it alive. I mean, we say you must keep it alive, not just that you can't kill it in the case of an abortion in the last 3 months. So the courts, I think, have been very clear here. They've also been very clear, but the reasons are not so clear here, that physicians and hospitals don't have to take parental refusals to treat to court. So that, for example, in the Johns Hopkins Down syndrome case, parents refused surgery for the rather simple surgery, refused consent for the rather simple surgery to remove an intestinal blockage. The child starves to death over 2 weeks. The hospital and the physicians did not go to court. Those physicians and that hospital were not prosecuted, and it's very questionable whether they could have been. Though it's very clear that the court would have ordered the surgery if it had gotten the case. Now, what that does, very clearly, you can see, is it puts the whole ball in the lap of the doctors and the hospital about whether to tolerate parental refusals of consent. Now, the reason I said that strikes me as harboring a lot of the same elements as Christian morality is this. When the court gets the case, the court says, we can exercise no more control over life and death decisions in the case of a defective infant than we can in the case of an adult. You keep them alive. Just because you don't want the person around or don't think its life is good enough, neither convenient burdens on you nor quality of the life of the entity of the baby itself justify create a legal right to let the child die. That is, people don't have that kind of control. And they have no really finally secure legal right that would be sanctioned by the society. The parallel would be individuals have no secure, morally secure right to let a defective infant die, sanctioned by God, sanctioned by the Christian community. Because quality of life considerations are not relevant when it gets to that final stage. But in between, the decision is obviously so anguishing that we will not take the decision-making matter out of the hands of free, struggling Christian parents. It's too anguishing a matter to take out of their hands and say, we know better than you. So oddly enough, the courts have said, every defective infant has as much of a right to live as anybody else in our society. But we're not going to tell any parents that we as a society know better than they do, in actuality. Well, obviously that way of portraying the situation, I think it shows some similarities between the legal thinking. I'm reading in a lot here between legal thinking and some themes, at least, in Christian morality. The latter theme, the freedom theme, would be don't put guilt, don't put that load of guilt on people by going to court and reversing, always going to court. So the law has not said you have to go to court. Well, that's the legal situation, and I think some reflections on the moral gist of it too. it is remarkably, as I've said, cognizant of the fact that we can't just do with people what we want. And just because a defective child is a burden, that doesn't mean at all we can do with them what we want. Now, if we get down to particular cases, what do we do? Should the physicians and the hospital staff have gone to court in the Johns Hopkins University Hospital Down Syndrome case? I think if we had a discussion of whether or not the parents initially should have made the decision to refuse consent to the surgery, we'd probably come out and say, no, they shouldn't have. But I think we have to go back to, and then you can say, well, since we'd make that decision that they're wrong, then we should just concentrate further on the question of whether we should come down a little hard on them, so to speak, for that wrong decision and go to court to get it reversed. But the reason I don't want to just assume that it's wrong and then go on to the discussion of whether or not to take it to court to reverse their wrong decision is that how wrong it is and why it's wrong will be very influential in our decision whether or not to go to court to get it reversed. So we're thrown right back into the discussion of why it's wrong. Let me just throw that case out to you. I don't want to regard it as a closed case. Is it wrong, and if so, why is it wrong? For the parents to have refused consent to the life-saving surgery in that case.
Well, I don't think it's wrong for them to refuse it because they know how what is ahead in life if they have other children or they know what they have been through already. And I don't think it's right to force them to have something done because that child is going to be looked after by them the rest of his life. And there's so many children mistreated already in the world that I think it's perfectly right that they make the decision.
Well, there are two things there. It might be right that they make the decision, but it might be wrong for them to decide not to keep the child alive.
I don't think so.
So you're saying it's both right for them to make the decision rather than somebody else to make it, and the decision that is right for them to make is the one they made. And the reasons would be the welfare of the other children in the family, or?
Well, the welfare of the child is the one who's got the problem, for one thing. And some people can take a lot more than other people. And some people are real strong. Like, you know, you've talked to people, you've read stories and everything about people who have raised pitifully retarded children and all this sort of thing and everything. And the child has been a blessing to them, and it's worked out wonderful. But there are many other cases that it hasn't. And I just feel that everybody's just not able to cope. And raising a child, you know, isn't a 1 or 2 year thing. You're still raising a child at 25 years old if they're going to college and unmarried and all that sort of thing. And some people are just not, they just are made differently, and let's face it.
A Down syndrome child can be very burdensome, and at times a very happy child and a very rewarding child, but mm-hmm. at times just an incredibly saddening problem.
I don't know if that's a realistic argument. In this day and age, I don't think it's really too unusual that a parent will absolutely refuse to acknowledge the birth of their Down syndrome child, and that child becomes a ward of the state before the child has ever left the hospital. I mean, there are a lot of options in our society.
Including giving it to the state.
Yeah, you would not be forced to take this child home. I don't believe in any state.
So that what the parents are doing is not saying whether or not the child should live or die. They're just saying they don't want it.
Right. Then that becomes a problem between the state and the hospital.
The state can decide whether it thinks it's right or wrong.
I haven't known directly of this, but I do believe that this happens, that these grotesquely deformed children or the Down syndrome even is grotesquely deformed to some parents. I've known one example. They simply will not acknowledge that child. I'm really firm ground, but I do think that is an alternative parents have in our very sophisticated society.
Well, I didn't know they had that choice. I really didn't, because I thought so many institutions and things were already so full that they just don't have room for
don't know what, I would be interested in knowing, but what do you do if a parent asks you, who's to take home?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I didn't know that they could, somebody else came in and took the child, but that, you know, parents do reject out of hand something that's terribly important.
I didn't know that they could.
Well, that one recently in Ohio, that was taken into a state institution.
Some spina bifida children grow up to be all right. I mean, they're crippled probably with braces, and then some don't even have that. Some are families even after they're gone. I had a child in special education that was a spina bifida child, very brilliant child. Very happy, his mother was happy to have him, everybody around him was happy, but maybe when he got out to the world he had problems, but he had such a fine brain that I think he got along anyway.
He may, however, have been one where the position of the protrusion on the spine enabled the physician to make a diagnosis that this child would turn out to be relatively normal. Back to the Down syndrome case. Are these arguments that have been presented plausible or not? There was a comment here, and then I'll get to the answer.
Well, I know of 4 cases of Down syndrome, and there must be degrees of it, because I know 2 cases where the babies were so severely Down syndrome that they were also very unhappy children. They cried all the time and that type of thing. That the parents put them in foster homes, but they with the state, paid for that care. And then I know of 2 cases where the children were, they were able to raise them in the family, and it went just fine. So, and the other 2 children died within the first couple of years, the 2 that were placed in homes.
Yes?
I think in that specific case, I would agree that it's the parent's right to make the decision as about the state to have that operation, but I don't think I agree with their decision when it was a minor problem that could have easily been corrected. And as a parent, I would have had a hard time. I couldn't have made that decision.
The Down syndrome is not a minor problem.
No, but the
intestinal obstruction is.
That they refused to be operated was, I guess, an easy operation. I guess I wouldn't have been able to make that decision and watch my baby starve to death. But I think it's the parents' decision as about the state's.
One could ask whether or not, if refusing to remove the intestinal obstruction is permissible, whether or not just not feeding the child would be permissible. And then some people conclude that since not feeding it would obviously not be permissible, they would think not removing the intestinal obstruction is also clearly wrong. Yes?
Well, in not feeding the child, though, aren't you? I think that could be argued more that you're taking an active part by not doing it in killing off the child. I don't know, I see that more as killing the child than by not performing the operation.
Except this operation is routine enough that I think it would not generally be come under this term extraordinary treatment or extraordinary care. We don't have to go to extraordinary means to keep somebody else alive.
So you're still
going
to the active part by saying, no, don't perform it. In the same way as you would by not feeding the child.
There's a continuum here. Intravenous feeding is an ordinary means of life saving. Food itself is clearly an ordinary means. A very, very complex operation that has only some chance of succeeding is an extraordinary means of life saving. And it's extraordinary means that we feel no obligation to provide.
Why?
It's probably a truth of definition. We define extraordinary means as those we don't have an obligation to provide. I suspect.
Is that a legal definition, Muslim?
What?
Is that a legal definition?
Yeah. It's not just a medical definition. There's no clear medical definition of extraordinary and ordinary. It gets to define the line between ordinary and extraordinary. We just have to go back to the moral controversy itself, when it's permissible to withhold treatment.
Well, Is, in terms of the case there, it seems that when we're speaking of our society, which to a great extent is a you know, a mixed bag of a lot of different things, a rather secular society, I guess one has to work in the whole area of what is effective law and what, you know, what you can do to make a law that will be helpful in a variety of cases, such as the one that you mentioned there. From a moral position, at least it seems to me that there's a lot, and people would disagree, but there's a lot of good grounds for life and the desire to keep life going. And I don't know what we do in our country in terms of those cases, but obviously, you know, just talking with people, the incidence of the blessings of retarded, Down syndrome kind of people are in our perceptions, I guess. You know, if you want to see, or you hope to see, or you're willing to see, my nephew is a great man. He's not retarded. He's a great man. But if you want to see him as, you know, as a burden, as a problem to my family and to my sister, then, you know, I guess, I don't know. Those would be some issues in our country where there would be great, you know, great division, I guess. But somewhere along the line, at least for some of us, there is a need to push for some kind of law to protect those kind of children, because some of us have a great fear that in our society, more and more these people are expendable, and the burdens of them, unless somebody protects them, that our society will less and less want to protect them.
And if it's too anguishing for the parents to raise such a child, then it is the obligation of the society to make provision for adoption, mm-hmm. state
Something
care.
Has to happen.
That is what a number of legal commentators and others too have been arguing for the last 5 years, 10 years since these cases have gotten a lot of discussion. They've argued that the courts have gone too slow.
But rights in our day is sort of the beginning to be the caboose in terms of economics. At least, I can't speak of other states, but the state of Washington, we are less interested in rights for special education, things of this nature. We're cutting back on those, so we're less likely to want to help that Down syndrome family with the economic burdens. And that family knows more and more that they will have to turn to other people besides the state, because the state is trying to get rid of its caseload, trying to push them out of the institutions. So those are some of the issues that, you know, are part of our legal system that I think make it a problem for families of this nature. I don't have any answer, just the problems they were connected with.
Clearly, if the state's going to get tighter and require and override the parental refusal of consent in these cases, it seems to me pretty clear that it's legally obligated to provide a lot more services.
Mm-hmm. Are you implying by that, Paul, that you feel that if the state steps in and tells the parents that it feels that their decision was an error, that the operation should be done in the case that you brought up, that the state then assumes all financial liability for the care of that infant?
If the parents, after that overturning of their decision, don't want the child, yes. The state is just the adopter of the child. If it can find another family,
That would be the same kind of thing as termination of parental rights. Is by refuting the parent's decision for that child, the state then terminates parental rights to that child. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the state could go either way. If the state issues a warrant for the treatment, that does not mean necessarily that the state takes over guardianship of the child. It might just issue a warrant for that particular action. and not take over general guardianship.
To take care of the child.
Right. And even refuse to take the child if the parents try to get it to take the child. But it seems to me, we could have a policy where we just said parents are obligated to care for their children even when they are severely defective, and the state has no obligation to take them over. And if they don't consent to life-saving medical procedures, the state will properly issue a warrant that those procedures be carried out, and the child will still be the child of the parents, full responsibility of the parents. That would be the clearest way of saying to parents, you don't have a right to make this refusal at all. But an intermediate stage would be to say, you don't have a right to make an effective refusal of consent. We will interpose ourselves, issue the warrant for the treatment, and then acknowledge your problems in making the decision by saying, we'll take the child if you don't want to continue to have it.
You say the parents would be billed then for the cost of all the care?
In the former, more rigid policies, you could well be.
I mean, what has happened in the past? Is there any precedent for that?
Well, the parents have not generally been billed. I don't know about the billing. It's usually not mentioned in any of the literature. I know one case in Seattle where there was a court order and the parents were not billed. And that was just considered.
Much of the time, anything like that come under the state's children's program, which takes care of that for the parents in the neighborhood.
In abused children, the parents' rights are terminated if they don't take care of them.
That's kind of what I was.
Yeah.
Playing with, if they abuse the child by withholding life, then that seems to me that they could just as reasonably do that by severely beating the child to the point where it dies as they can by withholding medical treatment so that the child dies. And if we terminate parental rights because of child abuse, which is inflicted physically, can we then deny parental rights?
Oh, we can't.
Is inflected morally, which might be even easier to show than the emotional child abuse that can go on.
Well, clearly the child abuse laws give the state, presently in most states, the power to take the child away from the parents if they refuse life-saving treatment. But that leaves open whether or not the state should take it away and whether the state is obligated to make the offer. It can if it wishes, but is it obligated to make the offer? Child abuse laws do not say, at least in Washington state, do not say the state is obligated to make the offer to the parents to take the child if the state overrides parental.
The state is an impersonal them kind of situation, and if in reality the state is supposed to reflect our desires, sure. Then should we not begin to address the issue of if we were going to make the laws that the state was going to carry out, what would we make? What kind of law would we make?
The law I would make would be for the state to offer to the parents to take the child.
Would
in that kind of case. Not would automatically
we,
take it.
Would we, in the as the state, and accepting that there are people who uphold our beliefs and people who don't, would we feel that if we would make a law that requires that reasonable, and let's leave reasonable as an easy definition for the moment, but would we require that reasonable steps be taken to assure as high a quality of life as possible for infants with disorders, whether they be physical disorders or mental disorders, or would we not make such a law?
Well, the courts have said, whether or not we make such a law, infants have a right to that protection. It's not a matter of legislative decision.
Basically, the problem.
Not the business of offering to take the child, but the business of mandating the life-saving treatment.
And it seems that what we're talking about, or pointing up in our discussion, is not a state legal problem, but rather one of the loopholes that exists in our imperfect legal system, because the legal system does not have burdock to go out and find these kinds of cases and review, turn the decisions around.
But the legal decision itself, at least the courts themselves, have decided not to have those bird dogs. They've decided not to require physicians and hospitals to come to court with those cases.
What about the neighbor? What about the grandmother?
Nobody's required present. And we might change that policy. We might make it like child abuse, where the physician is obligated to turn in evidence.
Could the disinterested third party take such a case to court? Could I hear of such a case and appear before a court?
Oh, sure. I think you could. Except if the testimony of the physician wasn't. If they didn't cooperate with you, you would get very far.
You're not likely to hear about it until it's
okay. Yes?
I've heard of a case recently, kind of extend this a little bit, where a doctor, I don't know where in the United States it happened, but a doctor and his wife delivered Siamese twins, and they made a decision, the doctor, the father that was a doctor made a decision in conjunction with the treating doctors not to feed these infants, and this was reported to the prosecuting authorities. The doctor that delivered the children and the parents are being possibly prosecuted for murder. This was very recent.
That's probably because of the feeding business. That legally distinguishes that case. The feeding, it's they just didn't feed them, right?
They made a decision not to feed them, similar to the one in the Down syndrome case.
It wasn't not intravenously feeding. It wasn't...
Right.
Not doing an operation to allow the digestive system.
Maybe they couldn't be separated, I don't know. But apparently, that decision was made.
And there are too many organs and too many structures.
Right.
They're still living.
It was just not giving mouth food.
Or intravenous.
Food by mouth.
Intravenous feeding, except fairly specialized, will not keep them alive. It just prolongs the inevitable.
Isn't there a quality of life in this?
Okay, one of the considerations mentioned, that you mentioned, was that the quality of the life of this child, for the child, not just for the parent, was low enough to warrant, not to warrant treatment. Could we assess that claim?
How would we establish that?
How would you establish it? Let's just throw that out.
One thing that occurs to me is if these individuals at a later stage in life choose not to continue their life. If the life of a Down syndrome adult, the few that survive to adulthood, they all turn around and jump off a bridge, you might want to ask, is their life so hard that they choose to reject it themselves, and therefore we, in their name and in their place, choose to remove responsibility and the horror that leads to those sorts of acts. My understanding is that that's not the case.
Well, a Down syndrome child, at least those that I've seen raised in homes, can be trained to even support themselves, a lot of them, and so therefore that quality of life, I mean, they have a quality of life and they can add a lot to life, but two children that are born so they can't be separated, what kind of a life could that be, you know?
A very different one.
Yeah, I mean, and they probably would be so miserable.
I don't know how to establish that there is any misery, that there is sufficient misery such that life, that the termination of their life is necessary and desirable.
Unless they themselves say it's desirable.
Well, even in that case, we are not, our culture doesn't tend to allow individuals to commit suicide. We do have statutes on the books that disallow that, don't we? We say that life is valuable enough that it's not your right to take your own.
No, that's not the reason we don't say that. It could be. But it could be that we have laws against suicide for other reasons. It could be that... that a person's wish not to continue life later is evidence that that person's quality of life to him or herself is not high enough to warrant continuing to live. But then we still have laws against suicide because we say the quality of life to yourself is not a sufficient consideration in the whole business of whether you're going to continue to live. But if it, but still, the fact that the person wants to commit suicide makes the act of refusing treatment when it's an infant an act sympathetic of the child rather than done for our sake. It's still problematic as to how we, certainly how we would ever know that the child would want to commit suicide later. In the case of Down syndrome children, it just isn't the case that they do. It is surprising how it varies with different defects, though. There's a television, there was a television interview many years back that I've been told about. I haven't seen it. In which one of the big talk show people on the major networks was interviewing two circus people in Florida who are severely physically abnormal. I'm not sure, I don't know what the abnormalities were. And at the end of talking about their life in circuses for 20 years or so, this interviewer asked them, well, you know, considering it all, and they seem to have a lot of positive things to say about should you, is it good that you live? You know, we now have the capacity to make decisions early about abnormal infancy. And they, much to this interviewer's surprise, said, no, we wish we had not been allowed to live. Now that we're here, we'll make the best of it. It's okay. But we really wish we hadn't been allowed to. Because it was social.
What? A lot of us think that.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how it came out. It was, I mean, it's. I'm not sure how we would decide that now we've got evidence that a person, in a person's own terms, life really isn't worth living. It's a very complex matter, as their comment and comparing it with others show.
I was wondering what animals did with their defective young. Just out of curiosity, do you know anything about that?
Well, I'm sure they probably, most of them would die naturally anyhow, and if they didn't, then many of them would be killed. And other human societies have done it too.
Well, I read the Seattle papers a lot, and I'm sure that like a year or two ago, they had big articles in the paper. They were running a series on this. And according to them, there are lots and lots of babies that are left to die in the hospital or, you know.
Because they don't get taken to court.
Yeah, it was just pitiful. I mean, it just makes your heart bleed. But I guess this is going on in the hospital.
Oh, sure. It's going on a lot.
Law or not the law, I don't know.
The law has given hospitals and doctors the freedom to decide whether to take these cases to court or not, which in effect gives parents freedom as long as it's in a cooperation with healthcare providers, but doesn't give them freedom once it gets to court.
In the case of these twin Siamese twins that were mentioned, would it have been possible to save the life of one and have a normal child? And that would be a bad decision to make, I'm sure, but would it be allowed?
There's another case that's come up where diagnosis of twins was made, and by amniocentesis they were able to show that one twin was defective and one twin was not defective. And give the mother the option to selectively abort one twin, selectively kill one twin during that pregnancy. Kind of distressing because the state of the art is just a little bit more advanced sometimes than our social, moral, ethical, and legal stance perhaps allows us to be, in which case it has to almost has kind of come to rest with, number one, the parents, and if the physician then decides that he feels the parents are wrong, and he feels it so strongly enough, then he can seek aid from the court. The hospital this point in our time frame, most nurses in newborn intensive care units are women. There's a great deal of distress in some of those units with some of the kinds of cases that are talked about here, and quotes letting children die, and how much you do for them or don't do for them. We allow adults that freedom, and most states now have passed an act that you and your physician can discuss what kinds of extenuating or life-saving care can be extended in your benefit should you have an accident or fall ill, and when the physician is to stop providing life support for you. And those decisions can be made voluntarily, and the state of Oregon has that law, for instance. So we allow adults the right to decide how much medical care they want in advance without putting their family under duress. And the extension of that then down to the newborn, it allows the family to make the decision about how much life saving can be done for the newborn.
What if the adult has not spoken with their physician ahead of time?
Then it's the physician and the family. Which oftentimes is a difficult situation for the family.
Mm-hmm. But then the court sometimes steps in too, as they do for young children. Like they did, for example, in the case of Karen Fuller,
the courts have not stepped in any case and said an infant has a right to die. A young infant, we're talking about before it's able to express it. They have stepped in and mandated life-saving treatment mm-hmm. when families or physicians have not wanted to provide it, but somebody else did and took it to court, but they have not said they have a right to. The courts haven't taken the welfare of the child and turned it into a decision to refuse treatment. Mm-hmm. An infant. Other younger children, able to express some wishes. Yes. Let me bring up just one matter here at the end before we break for first sitting of dinner. And that's expense. We've talked a bit about quality of life. I think you can immediately see how complex that quality of life business is, and asking what the interest of the child for its own sake would be is a very, very complex question. And tends us probably just by asking it to lean on the side of providing life-saving treatment in most of these cases. Not in all, however. But a further bothersome element is expense. Now, most people dealing with the issue have been inclined to say, well, if we're going to, as clearly as the courts have, say that infants have a right to life and parents can't refuse consent for quality of life reasons, for example, then if it got to court, then clearly they couldn't, nobody, hospital physicians, even society, or parents could decide that it wouldn't save an infant because it would cost $1 million over the next 5 years to keep it alive. If an infant has a right to life, it has a right to life, even if that protecting that right is very costly to the state. Costs are not something that can override rights if we decide something has a right to life. Well, it seems to me that here we shouldn't be that simply willing to rule out costs as a reason for letting an infant die. If we could assume that adults, most adults, the emphasis would have to be on almost all, would not want to have their lives prolonged at, say, the expense of, let's use a very high figure to make the case clear, $5 million, simply because they have enough empathy with other people who could use the $5 million and enough enough misgivings about having that much money poured into them for, say, perhaps only a few years of life, too. If most adults are going to say that, then isn't it permissible to read that same sort of decision into the potential mind of the child and say, well, we're not really doing anything for the child. We're not really acknowledging it, respecting it, acknowledging its autonomy, or what it would want if we spend $5 million keeping it alive. It seems to me that that's the right way to think about the matter. What's difficult is applying it, because we don't know very clearly what most people would, what the limit would be for most of us, and in what situations it certainly would vary. If it's 2 years of life yet, and relatively poor quality life, lying in a hospital bed, we wouldn't be willing to have much spent. We would refuse treatment, it would cost that much. It would cost even $100,000. But if, on the other hand, it's 30 years of life, and it's pretty good life, the figure would be much, much higher. Whatever the figure is, that will be the difficult thing to determine. But whatever it is, it seems to me we should read that same sort of figure back into the infant's case. So that expense, theoretically, clearly can become a reason for not treating a child. The problem is, it comes in not in that way of thinking, but, well, we just don't have the money now to pay for it. But that's because we haven't set up the channels by which we could provide the care. It all comes down on some individual family, and in some cases, and or a lot of it does. It certainly is a shame, even if the state's picking up the bulk of the tab for some family to refuse consent to treatment because $10,000 of the bill hits them that year and they're poor to begin with. Well, we didn't get a chance to go into that. I just